I just really want to take the opportunity to really thank Rabbi Berger for coming and joining us, both for those who are here and for the at least five people who approached me asking whether or not it will be recorded and available. And so we're just really excited. Rabbi Berger really has distinguished himself as someone with an outstanding reputation, in particular in the area of Nida Taras Mishpacha. He's been teaching it for, I don't know how many years, at the Stern, at the Talmud program, GPATS, or whatever they call it. And he's also someone that many people, I understand, consult him and discuss with him these areas of halacha. He's also practicing Shul Rav for many years. So it's really just a fantastic opportunity for us to have Rabbi Berger. And in addition, he's really someone who's very well known for being approachable and, in addition, very organized, very clear. And so I just thought he was really the perfect person to have join us. And so just once again, I want to take the opportunity to thank Rabbi Berger and wish him yasher koach for joining us this evening.
Okay. Thank you, Rabbi Sinemsky. Thank you for inviting me here today. It's an honor for me to be standing here in the Makom of Rabbi Sinemsky, a really genuine Talmud Chacham and a talented Rav that you're very fortunate to have here at Einstein. Okay, we're together here for about an hour. An hour in which we want to do some reasonably comprehensive review of Hilchos Nida to refresh everyone's memories and to try to help make sure that your practice in keeping these halachos is being maintained in a way that's accurate. People have a quick chasm class before they get married, and having a review every now and then is something that can be very helpful. Obviously, in an hour, we aren't going to be able to do any kind of truly comprehensive review of any area of halacha, and certainly of this one, which is quite large. So what I'd like to do during this hour is focus on particular areas and particular halachos and Hilchos Nida that I think are most important and most relevant. This means, number one, that we unfortunately aren't going to be able to seriously learn any of these topics and delve into the underpinnings behind them. We're going to be focusing on the bottom line halacha l'maisa. Number two, we are going to be focusing on parts of Hilchos Nida in particular that are most relevant to you in the room, to the husbands. If this were a shiur for women, it would be quite different. There are certainly a good idea for men to be aware of all of the Hilchos Nida that women need to be aware of, but for the purpose of this shiur, I think it would be most helpful to focus, not exclusively, but especially on those areas of Hilchos Nida that apply to, especially to your own personal shmir, your own personal keeping of these halachas. Okay, I want to begin by emphasizing that which we are, unfortunately, in a certain sense, not really going to be talking about for the next hour. There's something unfortunate about the way that people become educated or aware of Hilchos Nida. And that is, Hilchos Nida is unique in all of our Shmiras HaMitzvahs for those who were born into families of Shomri Mitzvahs, in that until one gets married, one has no real experience with keeping these mitzvahs. It's the only area of halacha where at a certain time in one's adult life, one sits down to learn something from scratch with which one has no actual personal experience. There's a mitzvah of chinuch, and we educate and train our children, and children who are fortunate to grow up in observant homes live the life of shmiras mitzvahs in almost all areas of halacha before they start to learn them. And Hilchos Nida is different. And so it's an area of halacha which one encounters completely dry at a moment in one's adult life. And it comes against the background of the first part of one's life, in which the whole area of sexual intimacy, which is what Hilchos Nida is of course about, has basically, without going into the details, one halacha, which is no. Right? And then when one begins to transition into the rest of one's life, in which one first encounters halachically sanctioned act of sexual intimacy as a part of one's life. The one's introduction to that is a whole series of classes in which one sits down and learns Hilchos Nida, which instead of being one big no, is lots of other smaller no's. This tends to create an environment in which the perception one gets about halacha and Torah and Yiddishkeit's sense of that sexual life that people have is one that's largely negative. And I think it's extraordinarily important when learning and when thinking about Hilchos Nida, despite the fact that the vast majority of the time, almost exclusively, is spent learning the halachos of Nida, is to recognize that environment, that picture that one tends to get, is in fact not accurate. If you think about it, in the typical case of a typical woman, what portion of married life is a woman in Ida? Is there a prohibition against sexual intimacy? During a time when a woman is not pregnant, somewhere in the area of 40%, and then there's pregnancy, which is a long period of time when a woman is generally permissible to her husband, and all of that is only given contemporary life expectancy, if one is zochet to have a long and healthy marriage. All of this only exists for about half of the length of that marriage, after which, when a woman gets older, she doesn't become a nida anymore to begin with. And so the percentage of marriage during which all of Hilchos Nida is relevant is less than half of the length of a marriage. And so even when we're coming at this from a perspective of halacha, the vast majority of married life is a time of heter, is a time when husband and wife are permissible to each other, and when that act of sexual intimacy is part and parcel of a healthy and happy marriage, and one that is viewed certainly by contemporary Gedolei Yisrael and contemporary Yiddishkeit across the entire spectrum, of Orthodox Judaism, is viewed as something extraordinarily positive and important and healthy, and something that is infused with Kedusha and that helps to infuse Kedusha in a person's life. And so, as we begin to learn Hilchos Nida, I think it's important to emphasize and to think about what Torah and Yiddishkeit has to say and mean for this aspect of your life is mostly not what we're going to spend the next hour talking about. Okay. In a similar way to which if one sits the lamp on Hilchos Kashrus, that does not define one's life of eating from a perspective, since largely it is something which is mutter. Okay, with that background, let's begin. Generally speaking, the world of Hilchos Nida is divided into three categories of halachos, three super categories of halachos. There's the corpus of halacha that addresses how does a woman become tmeah, how does a woman become an ida, what has to happen for a woman to become an ida. That's area number one. In chronological order. Area number two is what are the halachos that apply while a woman is an ida? And category number three is what is the process by which a woman becomes tahora again, stops being an ida? That's generally speaking, a map of Hilchos Nida. There are a couple of outlying topics which we will briefly address, but that's the general map. And we, generally speaking, will be addressing these halachos in that order. Before we do that, though, just a couple of brief words of introduction and foundations about Hilchos Nida. The first halacha that's especially important to know for everybody in this room is that there's a very basic halacha in Hilchos Nida which says, trust your wife. Okay? A woman has explicitly... Chazal Darshan from a pasuk, learned from a pasuk in the about Nida, that a woman has an emanus, a woman is to be trusted about her status of Nida, whether she's Tameya, whether she says she's Tahora, whether she says she's been to the mikvah, and so on and so forth down the line. That's basic halacha number one. All of these halachos are going to be addressing are based on information, right? All of these halachos are going to be, given a certain set of information, a certain set of circumstances, what's the halacha? The set of circumstances is something that the woman is absolutely trusted to provide. If your wife herself is unsure about the circumstances, obviously then one can be of assistance to her in trying to figure it out. Then one should never question one's wife's determination and presentation of what the circumstances are. What is the halacha of nida? So again, not going into the underlying complexities, the bottom line beginning of Hilchos Nida is that whenever a woman menstruates, another woman bleeds, any amount of dam, any amount of blood from her uterus, she becomes tameya, she becomes forbidden to her husband, until she has the opportunity to count shivaniki, until she has the opportunity to count, to go through an entire consecutive week, 7 days, without seeing any further dam at all. That's the basic rule. One needs to emphasize that dam nida specifically means blood, uterine blood, blood that comes from somewhere else is not dam nida, does not make the woman tameya. Now, often there are circumstances in which a woman finds some blood and doesn't know where the blood came from, is unsure whether it's dam nida or whether it's what's called dam maka, whether it's dam from some cut or something that's somewhere else. That is a fairly complex area of Hilchos Nida, and that is an area in which, when that issue comes up, one should always ask a shayla about whether one can be makel, whether one can be lenient about a circumstance in which the blood might be coming from somewhere else. I'll just mention one very common such example where one can generally be makel without really asking further questions, which is after a woman has a pap smear. Very often there is some small amount of bleeding. Generally speaking, one can assume that the blood that is found after a pap smear is cervical rather than uterine. I just realized I'm here at a medical school. I can use terminology. Hopefully, I guess some of you are husbands of medical students, rather than medical students, right? So I should be a little more careful. The blood from the cervix is not dam nida, and after a pap smear, so one can be makel about blood that's found after a pap smear. Okay. Now let's begin. With that basic background, that whenever a woman finds blood, she has to count Shiva Nikiyam, 7 clean days. Let's begin the first super category of these halachos. What has to happen for a woman to become Anita? How does a woman become Tameya? So, there has to be blood, and it has to come out of the uterus, and the halacha is it's only Tamei if it's certain specific colors. Okay, so a woman only becomes Tameya if the dam that she sees is various shades of red. And the way the halacha is practically, anything which is reddish is Tame. Now, obviously, reddish is not a very specific term. And for that reason, very often, it's unclear exactly, if the color is somewhat marginal, whether that dam, whether that blood makes the woman Tameya or not. Generally speaking, yellow is tahar, red is tamei, brown is a big machlokas. Most poskim these days are mostly makel about brown, but even with using these words, yellow and brown and red, still is trying to determine what the lines are between these colors is sometimes difficult. Therefore, whenever one is unsure about the color of the blood, one can show it to a posek, who can paskin whether the blood is a color that is problematic or not. Even when the woman herself, or if she's asking for a husband's assistance, if the husband also was simply, even before asking a shayla, is trying to determine the color of the blood, it's important to recognize that the lighting under which one looks at the dam can have a significant impact on the color that it looks like. Obviously, if you stood in a room with a red light bulb, then everything would look red, right? But there are subtler differences in different kinds of light where it's not so obvious. Incandescent light bulbs generally tinge a little bit towards the red, and therefore, if you look at dam underneath an incandescent light, you might end up tending to be more machmir than necessary. And if you look under fluorescent lights generally are more of a pure white light. They can maybe even push it a little more lakula. Halachically, the optimum light under which to look at the dawn, determine the color, is sunlight. Not sunlight when it's glaring sun, but in an environment in which there is sunlight, that's the best way to determine the color of the dam. So if anyone has any question about whether the color is tamei or tahor, if you're looking at it inside, so the first step is to try to look at it under the sun, and then you can tell better, and if you're still unsure, you can approach a posek. It's generally speaking a good idea. Here in this community, you have your own Morad Asra, and in your lives when you go on to the future, it's generally speaking a good idea to, unless it's not possible on a particular day, to be consistent about which posek you ask this kind of this especially even more than other areas of halacha that you ask this kind of shaila to, since different poskim have different standards and it's not so easy to teach them to somebody else, and so one should as much as possible have a consistent posek to address these kinds of issues. That posek shouldn't be me since I'm colorblind, so I'm completely incapacitated in this particular area of halacha, particular area of halachas nida. Okay. I mentioned before that blood, the dam, which comes from somewhere other than the uterus, is not tameh, does not make a woman forbidden, does not make a woman asura. In general, it's a good idea when a woman is planning a visit to a gynecologist or an obstetrician, in which something somewhat out of the ordinary is going to happen, it's not just a regular checkup. It's a good idea to be aware of hilchos nida related issues that could come up, because if there is a potential for bleeding to result from whatever is going to be happening at the doctor, it's good to know about it ahead of time so that either the visit can be scheduled in a way which doesn't cause problems, or at least one can be aware of the issues beforehand and be able to address it. It's not possible in this context to kind of go through every possible gynecological procedure, but it's just an important thing to be aware of. Anytime one is going for something that is not routine, it's a good idea to find out about it as much as possible beforehand. Speak to your Rav, who, if he has some experience with these issues, would likely be familiar with the particular situation, or consult with the doctor about what might happen. Okay, before we go into some more details, I just wanted to mention, this is an issue we're not going to be talking about, but I should just put it out there at some point, which is that the status of Nida that we're talking about is a status which applies identically to a Yoledes, to a woman who has just given birth, and the details associated with that are a whole other story, and that's something that you could, hopefully anyone who is expecting a child, especially for the first time, should speak to your Rav about what you need to be aware of before childbirth. There are a lot of halachos that one needs to be aware of in that context to make sure to plan that appropriately, but we're not going to be going into that in detail now. Okay, so we've talked about the blood. Okay, the blood that's tamei is restricted to certain colors. We also said that an orphan woman to become an Ida, she doesn't just have to have red uterine blood. She always has red uterine blood. She has to that blood has to come out, right? So what does that mean? What has to actually happen for this dam in order for the woman to become an Ida? So the answer is that it has to leave the uterus and cross some line, which is a little bit vague as to exactly where it is. What does coming out mean? Coming out doesn't mean coming out of the body. It means generally speaking, coming out of the uterus. If the dam passes the cervix but is still inside the woman, she's already an Ida at that point. Which is why if a woman does a bedika, actually, let's not get into that. Okay. Now, there are, speaking from a halachic, from a bottom line practical halachic perspective, there's an awful lot of background to this issue. But speaking from a bottom-line practical law perspective, there are basically three different scenarios of how the dam comes out that presents different halachic situations. Number one is the typical period. A woman is what we would call, you would use the verb, she's bleeding. Okay, there's blood that is coming out of her in some significant quantity, as is typical for a regular period. The word that's usually used here in America to describe that is a flow, but the blood is flowing. That's category number one. Category number two is when the blood is not flowing, but there's a woman found a little spot of blood, or maybe over time a few spots of blood, but it's not a lot. It's just little bits. We'll try to define this a little bit better in a few minutes. That's category number two. So there's flow, there's spot. And then the third category is a bedika. There are many contexts we'll talk about later in which a woman has to do a bedika, has to check for dam using internally using a cloth. And if there's blood that didn't flow out and it didn't come out in just a little spot, it didn't come out at all until she took it out with a bedika cloth. That's category number three. The reason why these categories are important is because there is a distinction among them with regard to whether the issue involved is Doraisa or the Rabbanan, and that has very significant implications. We'll start with a simple one. If the woman is either flowing blood, or if she finds blood on a bedika cloth, okay, those two are halachically, again, for most purposes, the bottom line halacha is those two are halachically identical. So if the blood is flowing, or if she finds dam on a bedika cloth, she is tamea, she's forbidden to her husband no matter what. It doesn't matter how much, it doesn't matter where it was found, she's tamea no matter what, with still the one proviso that it's reddish. Okay, the color is still significant in that circumstance. If, however, a woman finds only a spot or spots of blood, she's not really flowing, she didn't do a bedika, she just found on her clothing, on her underwear or elsewhere, she found some spots of blood, whether or not that makes her a nida depends on certain other rules. That is what's called the category of kesem, of a stain. And while even a spot of blood makes a woman tameh, there are many, many exceptions to that. And we're not going to go through all of them. I just want to mention the principal ones, which are three. Number one, any one of these three exceptions will render the woman tahora, render the woman permissible to her husband. Even any one of them. Number one, if the spot is very small, okay, there's a minimum size of a spot that makes a woman forbidden to her husband. That size is known in halacha as kegris va'od. There are different opinions about exactly how much that is. A typical psak with regard to that is the surface area of a penny. Some people use a dime. Some people use a nickel as a guide for the size. But we'll assume a penny for the moment. If the amount of dam, the amount of blood, is less than the size of a penny, then the woman is tahora. Only if it's more than the size of a penny is she tameh. There's more to say about that. Again, if I were talking to the women, I might talk about it more. But that's rule number one. Rule number two is that even if it's more than that size, the woman is still tahora if the dam is found on a beged savua, if the dam is found on clothing which is colored rather than white, which is why the general practice of women, a practice which is mentioned all the way back in the Gemara, is that when the woman is tahora, she, generally speaking, wears dark colors, and given our contemporary mode of dress, women generally specifically wear dark-colored underwear while they are not anida, so that if spots of blood are found on the clothing, it will not render her tameya because the clothing is colored. Now, there are some marginal cases: what's white, what's colored, off-white, beige. Generally speaking, it's a good idea lechatchila to wear dark colors. There are different opinions about these in-between colors, something which comes up fairly regularly. but we won't go into many posts are fairly makil about the definition of kalv. Number three, kula, number three, is that even if it's more than the size of a penny and it's found on something white, if that white thing that it's found on falls into the complex halachic category of a davar she'ino mekabel tuma, there are certain types of things which can become tameh and certain kinds of things which can't become tameh. If it falls into that category of something which can't become tameh, then the woman is also not tameh. Now, we can't go into to defining this in any length. I will just mention a couple of examples of davar she'ino mekabel tuma. Example number one is the floor. Okay, if a woman finds dam on the floor, even if it's more than a gris, more than a penny, and even if the floor is white, again, as long as she's not flowing, as long as it's just a spot, then she is still tahora. So that's the floor. There are many poskim who say the same thing, and this is very very practical, about pads. Women wear pads. There are some poskim who say that pads are not makabel tumah, so that even if a woman finds dam, finds blood on a pad, she is that's and the, which is white and it's more than a penny, she's still tahora. There are those who disagree with that, but there are those who are makel about that. Okay, so just to go back and summarize, so we've established that how does a woman become tameya, become forbidden to her husband, if uterine blood comes out of her, and it's reddish, and it either was flowing, or it was on a medica cloth, or it was a spot, and it fulfilled all these requirements. It was more than a penny, and it was white, and it was on a typical thing that is makabel tumah. So that's what we've said. That's how a woman becomes tameya. Yeah.
Just to clarify, toilet paper would also.
Got to talk about that. One second. Okay. Thank you. Good question. Okay, before we move on to the next major topic, I want to, there's a couple of loose ends here we need to tie up. One, and this I'm not really going to tie up, I just want to alert you to the issue. So we talked about flowing and spotting, right? And the important distinction between them. In the practice of Hilchos Nida, the trying to define the difference between these two things is one of the biggest conundrums in applying Hilchos Nida. Because very, very often, it's very difficult for a woman to determine whether it's just some spots or whether it's flowing. It's a very kind of qualitative distinction. And sometimes it's obvious, sometimes it's obviously flowing, more often than not it's obvious, but very often there are marginal situations where a woman is wearing colored and she's finding some blood, but it's not just one little spot, it's a few little spots, and it's hard to decide whether it's a flow or not. If it remains just called spotting, then since it's on color, she'll be a muteris. But if we call it a flow, then she'll be tameya, and it's admittedly difficult to define, and sometimes it needs a kind of a conversation between the woman and the posek to try to tease out what's going on, so that a judgment call can be made about whether that is a flow or a spot. I will mention just again a couple other loose ends. If a woman is spotting, and we said, and it's on colored clothing, so she's tahora. She might be tahora, but there's another rule, which is don't be stupid. Okay, if a woman is spotting, and especially she has some experience with this, and she kind of knows that, well, if she's spotting now, she's likely to start bleeding soon. It's in many cases, and this can be done either on one can make a judgment call on one's own or in consultation with a rav. It's not a halacha, but often it's a good idea if to abstain, at least for a short while, maybe for a day, to just make sure that she's not really bleeding, because you don't want to be intimate with each other and then find that she's bleeding at the time. And that's not a very good situation. So one should keep that one seichel in mind with regard to that as well. That it's not just the halacha on the page. One should keep in mind the realities of the situation. Finally, is the question that was raised a moment ago. There's a tremendous discussion in literature about the topic of toilet paper in Hilchos Nida. And it's very common for a woman who's tahora to find some blood on toilet paper in the bathroom. And this raises, and whether or not she's tamea or tahora in that circumstance is affected by many different factors and many different underlying halachic issues. One of which is the question of whether the toilet paper is makabel tuma or not, although there are other issues that need to be dealt with as well. I can't give a clear, universal answer. This is something there is a very live machlokas haposkim about this issue today. Generally speaking, there's a trend that poskim in Eretz Yisrael tend to be more machmir about this. Poskim here in America tend to be more mekel about this. I am myself in Hilchas Nida, certainly am a Talmud of Rabbi Willig. Rabbi Willig is definitely makel about this. Most of the poskim I think that you are likely to encounter are makel about this issue. That dam that's found on toilet paper is not metame the woman, with certain provisos which you don't really have time to go into. But that's in most cases. That's the bottom line. Although even many of the poskim who are makel about that still are not 100% comfortable being makel about it, and therefore advise that l'chatchila, it's preferable for the woman simply to not look and to avoid finding dam on toilet paper as much as possible. Okay, so that concludes our discussion of what has to happen in order for a woman to become an Ida. Obviously concluding a very, very brief overview. We now come to the second super category of halachos, and the one which obviously is most relevant to you here as the husbands, which is, what are the halachos that apply while the woman is an Ida? This is the area of halacha that's generally known as the halachos of the harchakos. The obviously sexual relations are forbidden. That's the basic pasuk in the Torah, the halacha of nida. But as in most areas of halacha, there is a kind of expanding circle of halachos that surround this that prohibit other things which are related to or close to or might lead to the underlying iser. And these categories in Hilchos Nida, these Isurim, range from things which are Doraisa, to things which are Drabanan, to things which are unclear what they are, to things which are only Minhagim. There's a whole range of statuses of these various things that we call the Harchakos. And generally speaking, I'm not going to go into every single one as to what status they have, but there is quite a range. Now, one brief word of introduction to the harchakos. What is the word, what's the root of the word harchaka? What does it mean?
Rachok,
which means?
Yeah.
Far. Okay. When we say harchakos in Hilchos Nida, far away, we're trying to stay far away from what? From the Doraisa. Okay. This is a very, very important point to be aware of in the context of life, married life, when a woman is an Ida. Okay? Generally speaking, when one asks that question in a room full of men, that's the answer you get. Okay? Certainly in a room full of men who have some experience learning Torah. That harchaka means we have all of these drabanans or right, whatever they are, to try to make sure that we stay far away from perhaps violating the actual underlying Isur Doraisa. Okay, of actual sexual relations. And you ask women, what does harchaka chakos mean? Far away from what? Very often, even among women who have experience learning Torah, as I said before, the answer you get is far away from me. Okay. It's extraordinarily important to be for men. To be aware of how incredibly different the experience of living with Hilchos Nida is for men than it is for women. Okay? Both men and women have sexual drives, and both men and women have difficulty with abstinence, but you're not the Nida. And how one feels and experiences this period of abstinence is very different. There's a very strong tendency for women, and there could be a million reasons for this, we don't have time to go into the reasons, but women often, obviously this is not universal, tend to feel that, especially as a result of all these harchakos that we're going to talk about, that their husband is very far away from her, and that, you know, there's something wrong with her, to say it in a more radical formulation, which maybe is not quite true in most cases. But the sense of distance is in many situations very difficult for the women in the marriage in a way that is different than it is for men. Which one is correct? Which one is actually what the word harchakos means in its original context? It doesn't really matter, but you could argue both ways. I always thought that the most likely meaning is in fact what the gentleman here said, which is that if anybody remember the very first Mishnah in Shas? Okay, the very first Mishnah in Shas talks about this. Okay, the very first Mishnah in Shas says that you're supposed to say Kriya Shema Shel Arvis, Kriya Shema at night. You're supposed to say it before Chatzos, even though the Zman of Kriya Shema goes really until the morning, but Midrabanan, you're supposed to say Kriya Shema before Chatzos. And so too, Hector Halavim Vevarim, the Beis HaMikdash, when they put the parts of the animals on the Mizbeach to burn during the night, also could be done until the morning, but they said to do it before Chatzos. Midrabanan, why? Kedei Laharchik Es Ha'adam Min Ha'Avera. Okay, the very first mission in Shas, to keep a person far away from the Avera. The notion of harchaka min ha'avera, of staying far away from an Avera, is a fundamental notion in the whole existence of Dinim Derabanan. So that's what the harchakos are really about. On the other hand, there is the first in Evan Ezer, Simon Chaf Aleph, which talks about, in the Shulchan Aruch, where the Shulchan Aruch talks about not with the husband and wife, but in general with regard to arayos, with regard to forbidden sexual relations, it says that the exact words, I think it's tzarech adam lehisrachek min hanashim ma'od ma'od, right? That a person should stay far, very, very far away from women because of the power of sexual desire. And that's obviously not about marriage. That's about, in general, otherwise. So be all the underlying issues as they may, in practice, it's very, very important to keep this issue in mind and to recognize that the halachos of nida do not require and do not ask that husband and wife be far away from each other in any sense beyond what the halachos here say, which are very specific. And it's because of the way that women tended to feel during the period of nida, it's dafka extra important for husbands to be to be particularly sensitive to their wives' feelings at this time, at a time when touch is not allowed, and to do your utmost to try to reduce the difficulties and to make sure that your wives feel loved, feel as close as possible, feel that the marriage hasn't been interrupted during that period of time. Works the other way too, for the men too, but the issue is more pronounced in this direction. Okay, so what are the harchakos? Number one is just general, is kind of general, which is that husband and wife are required to avoid any type of interaction, conversation, playfulness, that is the kind of activity that for that particular couple tends to lead to intimacy. That's something that's difficult to define. It's different in different cultures. It's different for different people. There are circles in which people say that it's usher for husband and wife to say "I love you" to each other when they're in nida, because that's something that's associated with intimacy. In other cultural contexts, that's simply not true, and that's something which people say all the time, and it's not necessarily specifically associated with intimacy or likely to lead to anything. We're getting a little short on time. So that's one general area, is just to avoid the kind of interaction that tends to lead to sexual intimacy. Number two is the what's called the issur of histaklos. It's forbidden, and this only goes in one direction. It's forbidden for a husband to be mistakel, to look at his wife's at certain parts of his wife's body while she's an Ida. Specifically, the husband is not allowed to look at the parts of his wife's body that are usually covered. Usually covered means usually covered at home, right? Not usually covered in the street. So, for example, if a woman covers her hair when she goes outside, but at home she doesn't cover her hair, there's no iser of histaklos of looking at the woman's hair. That's considered an uncovered part of the body because she generally keeps it covered at home. But there's a couple of points that need to be made about this. First of all, what does the verb mean? Histakel. Okay. Histakel does not mean that it's forbidden to see. Right? It doesn't say it's usher liros. Right? So it's usher lehistakel. How would you translate lehistakel?
Gaze.
Okay, gaze. Now, the problem is that there are, in English, there are so many different words you could use that have different connotations, right? Is it gaze? Is it stare? Is it look? Right? And those are different from each other, right? Supposedly, I once heard somebody else from Lichtenstein about this, and he came up, he's, you know, an expert in English. His translation of histakel was peer. Okay. That was his word. But the point is that a husband doesn't have to walk around with his eyes closed in his house because his wife is not completely dressed. He just has to control himself and not look. Okay, so a person shouldn't be dafka making a point of looking at, again, parts of his wife's body that are usually covered. It's completely mudur for a husband to stare as much as he wants at what parts of his wife's body that usually aren't covered. Okay, a husband can stare at his wife and appreciate her beauty as much as he wants, as long as it's not makomos mechusim, as long as it's not parts of his body that usually covered while she's washing it up. Final point about this is that it needs to be emphasized. This halacha. And people, very often I get the sense people misconstrue this halacha. This halacha is 100% the responsibility of the husband, not of the wife. Okay, there is no halacha that a woman is not allowed to get undressed in the room where her husband is while she's in Ida. If it happens to be that that makes it difficult for her husband, and she wants to be nice to him, which she should, then fine. But the halacha here is that it's his responsibility not to look. Okay, this halacha imposes no restrictions on her, unless, as part of a healthy marriage to some degree, she feels that it's something she should do. But this is a halacha for the husband, not for the wife. Okay. next. A husband should not, again, b'chavana, again, on purpose, sniff his wife's scent, right? Perfume or shampoo, whatever it is. Obviously, a husband is close to his wife. He's going to smell her aroma, but he shouldn't go out of his way to do it. That's something that's of intimacy. There's a whole big discussion about the question of kol isha while a woman is anida. And there are different opinions about this. Generally speaking, certainly it's not a good idea for a woman to, you know, serenade her husband while she's anida. You know, something that's dafka, something that'd be kind of intimate. But you know, if she's trying to sing a lullaby to the baby to put him to sleep, you don't really have to worry about that issue. The next one of the harchakos is that it's forbidden for husband and wife to touch each other while she's anida, at all in any fashion. That includes touching skin to skin. It includes touching, you know, through clothing. Negiya, touching is forbidden while she is anida. Alongside this halacha, there is another one, which is most probably a minhag, that forbids handing things to each other, the iser koshata, while a woman is anida. This rule applies to small things, it applies to big things. One also should not throw things directly to each other. There are different shittos, and the bottom line, I think most poskim hold that it's kind of you can throw something if you throw it up, not if you throw it straight. That's the iser koshata. This halacha, or minhag, exactly however you want it, however it's defined, is, although it's you know, not of the greatest significance in the halachic sources, is obviously one of the most common issues that happens on a regular basis while a woman is anida. It's one of the most minute-to-minute things that people need to keep while the woman is anida. Being that given the history of this halacha, again, I can't go into details, there are circumstances in which some poskim are willing to be makil about certain things with regard to this. For example, if you're traveling somewhere on a bus and you have to get off the bus and you have a stroller and you need to be able to hand the stroller to someone or you're getting off the bus, many poskim are makil to allow that in that kind of difficult circumstance. One should avoid, if possible, not just handing things to each other, but picking something up together. So if you want to move furniture, it's best to avoid that unless it's really necessary. One of the most important applications of this issue and the big machlokas that arises in this case has to do with babies. Is it forbidden for husband and wife to hand a baby to each other while she's in nida? This is particularly important because a woman, when she gives birth, is always automatically becomes a nida, and so for the first few weeks where there's a newborn in the house, a woman is always forbidden to her husband. So this issue of handing a baby to each other is a very regular and important issue, and very widely diverging piskei halacha about this issue. I will just mention that many people are simply machmir. It's just like handing anything else. And instead of handing the baby to each other, you have to put the baby down, and then the other person should pick the baby up. I should mention that Rabbi Willig says mutter. Like, don't worry about handing babies to each other. He says that it's mutter. I can't go into all the details. One important, very very important point to make though, again, which is if one is being machmir about this issue, okay, this issue, even if it's very perfectly reasonable, very reasonable to be machmir to not hand the baby to each other, but it's not something that's important enough to risk the baby's life. Okay, I have seen people, the Moe and I have seen people. They're getting into the car and they need to do something, and I'll put the baby on top of the car, right? So the other person picks the baby. Okay, again, I said before, don't be stupid. Okay, in any such kind of difficult circumstance, hand the baby to each other. Don't worry about it. Rabbi Willig says even if you're going to end up touching when you hand the baby to each other, you can be makel about that too. Under that, with regard to babies, yes.
What about if the baby did something like?
So we'll get to that. I forgot about that, but thank you for bringing it up. I'll get to that in a second. Thanks, Mia. I'll get back to that in a second. There's another issue that comes up with regard to Hoshata, which is there are very many people often ask. It's very embarrassing. Right, they're in public. There are people are watching, and they know that it looks funny that they're not handing things to each other. You know, I have to give him the keys. I put it down on the table. This comes up very often during Havdalah when you're passing around the besamim, and instead of passing the besamim, you have to put it down first. So, and if somebody else is around, the husband is often embarrassed. That means people are going to know that she's a nida. So there are differing opinions about whether a person's feeling they're going to be embarrassed as a result of being machmir about hoshata is a reason to be mako. Rabbi Willig is machmir about this. Rabbi Willig has a general attitude about this that people tend to be overly worried and that they think people are staring at them and they aren't really, and people have plenty of other things in their mind and they're not really watching. And so that's generally his approach. Rav Moshe Feinstein is also machmir about this. Others are makel. I was told, I didn't hear it myself, but I was told that Rabbi Neuberger was makel about this. Rabbi Neuberger used to be a rabbi here actually many years ago, right? I believe that he was makel about this. I once heard a story from in Gush that supposedly it was the Kol families were eating in the dining room in the yeshiva, and somebody, you know, did something, I think with a baby actually, you know, that was sort of very obvious. Supposedly Rav Amital, Zichrono Livracha, walked over to the table and said, it's not a mitzvah for the whole world to know that your wife's a nida. it was Mikhail Dasya. But there are very differing opinions about this, about that issue. You asked a question about if the baby's in a carrier. So, with regard to the baby issue, it's exactly the same. I don't think there's any reason to distinguish. There is, however, an important issue. It's usher to hand something in the other person's hand. Okay? But what about putting in something into something which is in the other person's hand? Let's say somebody's holding a bag. Can I put something in the bag? So again, there are different opinions. But Willig is completely makel about that. Which is, if you have that kula, then it solves many, many problems. If a woman wants to hand his wife the keys so he can put it in her purse instead of putting it in her hand, and that's mutter. Next, one of now we come to harchakos, which are related more to the bedroom. Number one is the fact that husband and wife, when she's in Ida, may not lie down on the same bed. Okay? Nor may they lie down on two beds which are touching each other. This is, if not the most, almost the most chamur, the most serious of all of the harhagos. Right? There's almost nothing that's more intimate and more likely to lead to sexual intimacy than lying down together on the same bed, even more than negia, probably. There's certainly most kinds of negia, and therefore this harhaga is taken very, very seriously. The beds they can't be the same bed; they can't be touching each other. The blankets should preferably not be touching each other either. Every frum couple has to have twin beds rather than a king size bed, and this becomes an issue sometimes when traveling. Okay, when you're going on vacation, you have to be very careful to plan ahead so you know that where you're going, the accommodations will be such that this can be taken care of. Parenthetically, I just mentioned is something that's often left out of chasam kala classes and people are unaware of what to do. I'll just mention that there are a few times when husband and wife are forbidden to each other when she's not a nida. Which, I forgot that we started 8 minutes late, so I have straight minutes. Okay, fine. So when is a woman forbidden to her husband, even if she's tahora? Tishabav, Yom Kippur, and also, unfortunately, in times of Avelos. We won't talk about Avelos, we'll talk about the more regular scenarios. What are the halachas of the Archakos, Yom Kippur, and Tishabav? People often kind of gloss over this issue. So if the woman happens to be a Nida on Yom Kippur and Tishabav, so she's a Nida, so obviously all of the regular Archakos apply. But if a woman is Tahora, what besides the prohibition of sexual relations itself applies between husband and wife on Yom Kippur and on Tisha B'Av? So there are different opinions about this issue. The ranging from the Maharil, who holds that all of our fakos apply, the Mishnah Berurah is noted, leans towards being machmir like that. And the on the other end of the spectrum, this is what the Shulchan Aruch paskins, is that the only harchakos that are even a matter of discussion in Kippur and Tisha B'Av are negia, touching, and mita achas, and being in the same bed. Okay. So halacha lamaisa, there are some finer distinctions that are made according to the Zataz and Magen Avram, different opinions of the distinguishing made between Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av. But bottom line is, certainly, beds should be separated on Yom Kippur night and the Tisha B'Av night. Right? That is certainly the case according to all poskim. Negia, there are different, more differing opinions about that on Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av. Okay, moving down to the further of the harfakos. The next one is what's known as the halacha of safsal hamisnadneid, that husband and wife should not sit together on the same bench when the bench is kind of wobbly, right? When one person can feel the other person sitting down on the bench. I should mention right away, this whole issue exists only in Minhag Ashkenaz. Minhag Sfarad, there's no, this whole halacha doesn't exist at all, but that is the halacha in Minhag Ashkenaz. This becomes an issue with sitting on couches. Couches that have separate pillows on them, so it kind of depends on the couch. You have to see if one person can feel the other person, then you really should avoid sitting on the same, even if they're separate pillows, on the same couch when the woman is in Nida. This halacha, however, does not apply, generally speaking, when traveling. If you're going on a bus or in a car or on a plane, usually now they're all separate seats anyway, but if there's like a bench and it's butter when traveling, generally speaking, to travel together on the same bench. Sometimes one has to be careful about negia when traveling together. Suppose the couple is going on a plane together somewhere while she's in Ida and you're not in first class, and then it's very hard to not touch the person sitting next to you, so you should try to put something in between you to avoid the touching in that circumstance. The next one of the harchakos is to avoid lying down in each other's beds. A husband shouldn't lie down in his wife's bed, a wife shouldn't lie down in her husband's bed. Since you're the husbands, I'll just mention the specifics. The minhag, generally speaking, is that a husband should not lie down in his wife's bed at all, and he can sit in his wife's bed and not lie down, but only when she's not there, only not in her presence. One of the harchakos has to do with making the beds. You shouldn't make each other's beds when the other person is there. I don't know how often that happens, but as long as the other person is not there, it's mutter. Okay. We then come to the last category of hachakos, which are the ones that apply in the dining room to eating. The first one, there are three. The first one of these hachakos is that husband and wife should not serve drinks to each other. Again, there are different opinions. The bottom line for minhag Sfarad is that this only applies to drinks, maybe only to wine. And minhag Ashkenaz, generally speaking, is that this applies both to drinks and to food. So the husband and wife should not put down a drink or a plate of food in front of the other person. However, as long as it's done with some sort of shinoi, with some sort of unusual manner, it's mutter. So you can put it down, you know, a few inches off center, or you can put it down in some unusual way. That's mutter. I should mention that Rabbi Willig, also, that's also only usher when the person is sitting there. It's not usher to put it on the table if the person's not there. Rabbi Willig, for unique shita, as far as I know, among Ashkenazi poskim nowadays, he's nakel about the food. He only is machmir about drinks, like generally speaking, the next farah. Okay. Husband and wife also, the next one, should not eat together at the same table unless they put some sort of something on the table in between them, or they have separate placemats to encourage some recognition that they're separate, so that they don't accidentally touch each other and so forth. There's a big machlokes as to whether this rule applies if they're not alone, right? If there's the halacha, if somebody else is sitting in between them, then that's fine. If they're sitting at a table, they're next to each other, but sitting at a table with other people, so there are some who are makel, some who are machmir. Rabbi Willig is very makel about this also. He says that if anybody else is at the table, you don't need to put a heker in between, you don't need anything on the table, even if those other people are just your children. So even if it's like a small child, as long as the child is sitting, I mean, if it's a baby and a carrier on the floor, that doesn't count. But if there's a child sitting at the table, then that's enough. You don't have to worry about that issue at all. This issue also comes up not just when you're eating at the same table, but when you're eating not at a table at all, when you're eating out of the same dish, that's even more chamor. You can't share a bag of popcorn or share the bowl of nuts, or that's something that should be avoided. The last of these halachos is that the husband should not eat his wife's leftovers. This only goes in that direction, not the other direction. If a woman, you know, if the wife drinks something, she leaves over some stuff in the glass, he shouldn't finish it, but that's only if in her presence. Once she leaves the room, that's mutter as well. Okay. The questions sometimes come up about how to deal with harchakos when somebody's sick. If the husband is sick or if the wife is sick, it comes up especially when during childbirth and labor and so forth. That's a too broad an issue to go into now. It's just bring it up so that people should ask questions if that circumstance comes up. Okay. Finally and briefly, we've just completed the discussion of what are the halachos that apply while a woman is in Eda, which was the one I spent the most time on because it's the most relevant to the husbands in the room. The last, like I called super category of halachos, is how does a woman become tahora again? So just very, very briefly to the details of this are not something that, generally speaking, that you have to do, although it's good to be aware of it. Generally speaking, once a woman becomes tamea, in order to become tahora again, she has to, the simple way to put it, she has to wait 5 days and then count 7 days. Okay, she has to wait 5 days and then count 7 days. The seven are the seven clean days, then the Nikiyim. This is a very good example of why refresher classes are important. A friend of mine told me that his wife was once giving a refresher, this was Liora Bednar, she was giving a refresher class at Hilchos Nida, and it turned out one of the women in the room, who had been married for at least 10 years, turned out she had gotten it backwards. Right? She was waiting seven and counting five instead of waiting five and counting seven. Okay, easy mistake to make, but an important one. Okay, so these refresher classes are a good idea. So a woman has to wait on the fifth day. She does her first bedika called the Hefsek Tahara, and if it's clean, then she had the following 7 days are the clean days, and she then go to the mikveh. After that, the Hefsek Tahara, the first bedika, is not day one of the Shiva Nikiyim, it's day zero of the 7 days. The following day is day one. The easy way to remember it is that the afternoon on which that first bedika, the Hefsek Tahara, is done, it will be the evening of the Tzvila the following week. Okay, 7 days. 7 days later. L'chadchila, generally speaking, a woman does bedikos twice every day during the Shivan Akiyam, one in the morning, one at night, and the Gwel is wearing white underwear during the course of the Shivan Akiyam. One thing that's important for everybody here even to know is that when there are situations of difficulty, always ask shailas. Because there are many, you know, these halachas are complex, and there are many areas in which there are situations in which one can be more makel, and sometimes much more makel, than what the usual rules are in certain extenuating circumstances. So, with regard to how many bedikos one does during Shivan Akiyam and wearing white and so forth, if there's any issue that comes up, it never hurts to ask. Asking more rather than less is always a good idea. After the woman counts her Shivan Akiyam, she then goes to the mikveh. I don't think it's important to discuss almost anything about tevila here with the husbands. Just a couple of very small things. Number one is the fact that, generally speaking, the tevila has to be done at night and not during the day. Here again, in certain extenuating circumstances, you know, it's a 3-day yontif and there's no mikveh in town, or you're going on a vacation somewhere where there's no mikveh and you're leaving leaving before nightfall. There are extenuating circumstances. Always ask a shayla about whether it's permissible to go to mikveh during the day. Under certain circumstances, one can be makel about that as well. Before a woman goes to the mikveh, she does a chafifa. She washes and cleans herself very well and combs her hair to make sure there's nothing on her body before she goes to the mikveh. That chafifa is supposed to be started during the day and completed during the night when the tevila is going to be done. The last point I'll mention about the tevila is just that the tevila is supposed to be done, betznius, tevila is supposed to be done in a private way, and that means two different things. It means that, number one, the tevila itself should be somewhere where people can't see, obviously. Right? It also means that the fact that the woman is going to the mikveh now is something that shouldn't be public. Right? You shouldn't have something a woman or a husband should be telling people, oh, you know, I'm going to the mikveh tonight, or my wife's going to the mikveh tonight. That's something that's considered a gross violation of tznias, and it's not something that should be made public. However, my sense is that people tend to be, in some cases, to be overly machmir about this. Okay, this halacha doesn't mean that it's usher to tell anybody that you're going to the mikveh. It means it should be kept, you know, quiet and not public. But if in order logistically to get to the mikveh, you have to tell someone, then it's mutter. Okay? If you need a babysitter to watch the kids so a woman can go to the mikveh, and it's the circumstance is such that even if you don't tell the person, it's going to be obvious that's what's going on. It's mutter. It's not usser. It's not usser to make sure. It's not a requirement to make sure nobody knows she's going to the mikveh. It's just something that should be done as quietly and as bitznius as is possible. This issue is particularly difficult on Yamim Tovim. When the biggest issue was Leil HaSeder. Woman has to go to the mikveh on Leil HaSeder. It's a nightmare. Okay, it's a nightmare both in terms of the logistics themselves of when to go, and especially since it's huge. Very often there's 25 people at the Seder, and you know, how are you going to do it? Who's going to know? And so that's an issue. And with that in mind, it's also important to mention something else. Generally speaking, a woman should go to the mikveh as soon as she can, right? The night of the tevila, as soon as she's finished her Shivan Akiyam, she should go to the mikveh. There's especially if she's of childbearing age and there's a mitzvah of puravu, one should not delay. And even in general, there's a notion that if a woman can become tahor with her husband, that's what should be done. This also is something that. There are different kind of schools of thought with regard to this. There are some circles in which this is viewed very, very firmly. In other circles, less so. I think that sometimes people, again, are a little too sensitive about this issue. It is important, but if it's really very, very difficult to get to the mikvah on the Leil HaSeder, it's not the end of the world if she waits till tomorrow. As long as it's done completely b'shalom with the agreement of husband and wife, without any, you know, pressure one way or the other, if it's perfectly fine with both of them, then again, one should try to avoid it, but it's not something that one doesn't have to jump through ridiculous hoops to be able to do that. This comes up also sometimes people have to go to a wedding on a certain night. That's something to keep in mind. Yeah?
I'm just wondering, as opposed to, let's say, dress, so this was the eighth day,
mm-hmm.
and if it's pushed off, then once the next day is real, kind of problematic, like the Shabbos or something, you kind of push it off till
mm-hmm.
Sunday. So is this, if the mitzvah is to go on the night, mm-hmm. you know, tonight that she's tahor,
mm-hmm.
and you push it off until late all seder, the next night, the second night of Pesach or something else, some other like Shabbos or something.
Yeah.
At that point, you say like, because going to the mitzvah, it's, you know, she's bathing and this and that.
Yeah.
And you know, we permit it because it's a, you know, mitzvah. But when she's pushing it off from the optimal night, you just say
okay. Push it over. So there's something to what you're saying in the kind of original underlying sugya about this issue. However, bottom line, the answer is no. Bottom line, there's, you know, once it's been pushed off, that's not a reason to push it off further. In fact, one might argue the opposite, that you know, the longer you wait, the longer you're waiting. You don't want to wait. You know, you should wait less, not more. Yeah.
Generally, when people push it off, do they push off just the tefillah or also the shem kiyum at the same
time? We're talking about pushing off the tevila, right? If she started the Shiva Nikiyam late, because usually people don't think that far in advance. So usually...
A week in advance.
If you see that it's going to come out that way. Usually not. Usually people will do the Shiva Nikiyam when they can, and they'll just wait another day to go to the mikvah. Honestly, it doesn't really matter, but that's usually what people will do. Okay. Now, there's, besides these three super categories of halachos, how does a woman become an Ida, what happens when she is an Ida, and how does she cease to be an Ida, there are two kind of ancillary areas of halachos nida, which we're not really going to discuss at all now. I just want to mention them. One is the special halachos that apply to a kala, is in a series of issues that come up with regard to the very beginning of marriage, which are not really relevant to a refresher course. And number two, which is a very big area of halacha, but again, weighs the halachos of vestos. And just 30 seconds about vestos, again, something which would need to be addressed in much greater detail with the women. The halacha is that even when a woman is tahora, even when she's not a nida, if a time arrives during which there's reason to expect that she's going to become tamea, that the husband and wife have to abstain at that time to avoid accidentally having sexual relations while she's nida if she suddenly starts to bleed during that time when she's expected to start. That's what's known as a vestos. The halachos of vestos are complicated. Your wife will calculate her vestos and tell you when they are. Sometimes it could be three nights during a month. Sometimes it can be two. Sometimes it can be one. Sometimes it's zero. Sometimes they're during the day and not at night, so it's less relevant. But those halachos are important for the time when the period might be expected. The one important thing for you as the men to be aware of is that there's some difference of opinion about this, but I'll just tell you what's generally accepted, at least in the circles that I walk in, which is that during the vestas, only sexual relations are forbidden, and none of the harfakos at all apply. Okay, during the time of Vestas, all kinds of negiyah are permissible. Just the basic underlying isser is forbidden during the Vestas. The vestos are greatly impacted if a person is on a pill or some other form of hormonal birth control. Again, that goes to the question of the calculation of vestos, which we're not going to go into. That's basically my overview. I'll just conclude with emphasizing two things once again. One is what I began with, which is that despite this hour-long litany of details of halacha, one should always keep in mind when thinking about these issues that the period of nida is a minority of one's married life and not a majority, and what the Torah has to offer about thinking about one's sexual life is not just isurim and all of these details. There's much positive to be emphasized also. And finally, in a more practical sense, I already mentioned this once before, but whenever questions come up in the area of halachos nida, it's always very valuable to ask more questions rather than fewer questions. Some people are somewhat embarrassed because the whole area of halacha is a matter of sensitivity, which should be emphasized that rabbanim are are completely used to dealing with these issues, and one should try one's best to not feel that way about approaching these issues with a rav. And in many cases, there are all sorts of either kulas or suggestions of how to handle a situation that can help help avoid all sorts of difficult issues that people might be facing, which they didn't necessarily imagine there might be a way out of. So whenever one is facing something that's causing a husband or wife or both any suffering at all, one should always ask as many questions as possible from every pressing circumstance, meaning anything from if someone is undergoing fertility treatments and trying to have a baby, and these issues are putting a crimp on the success, all the way down to as well as Seder and I can't go to the mikvah, this whole spectrum of issues. There might be potential solutions for that you might not be thinking of, and you should always ask. Thank you again for inviting me here, and I'm happy to answer any more questions that people want to ask, either in this forum or privately. Should I take questions now, or anything else? Nope. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
So you were just. Okay, so that's something which falls into the category that I talked about at the beginning, in which there are kind of cultural differences and maybe personal differences among different people. It depends on it's actually, I think, one of the Hasidic poskim, I think, is a hoch. I think the Deborah Ziner, I think, and the Shul Shuvah Be'er Moshe, I think he has whole tshuva about ping pong, I think. Not thick. One, you're not supposed to throw a ball to each other. That's the sort of hoshata, right? So depending on the particular sport, there might be another issue that comes up anyway. Whether or not simply playing together is something that's considered intimate really depends on the particular people involved. My guess is that I shouldn't say it really is dependent on the sport and on the people. So you kind of have to, some things you have to be left up to your own judgment, and I think that's the case with regard to that. I'm sorry?
And how good you are.
It might depend on how good you are. Right.
I will with the baby. Is that 100% any situation, or only when it's going to
be? He says, don't think about it. Okay? Yeah?
All right, if it's like snowing and your wife needs to cross an icy puddle or whatever, would you rather her fall down, or would you rather her... You stay your arm down and cover across the
end. So there's a Gemara about that, right? The Gemara says in Masechta Sota, it's Masechta Sin Sota. It's in Sota. The Gemara says that there's something called a Chassid Shota, right? Something called someone the pious idiot. Okay? The pious idiot, says the Gemara, is the person who sees a woman drowning and doesn't save her because he shouldn't be looking at the woman. Okay? So, in any circumstance in which there is some potential, danger, as in any such situation, you shouldn't worry about something like this. On the other hand, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't try to resolve the situation in some other reasonable way otherwise. And even if you do so, you should try to do it normally speaking, a typical adult or a typical woman can cross the icy patch as well as you can. I mean, if the issue would usually come up if she's pregnant or if she's sick or if she's, whatever. The issue is, use your head. You should try, using any reasonable means to avoid it. But if there's a reason to avoid it, then, again, yeah.
Have you
find daylight
lights, which some are supposed to...
Right, the daylight lights.
I don't know if anyone has...
So Rabbi Willig has such a lamp in his living room. that's difficult if you're someone who's studying to be a posek in this area, that's a relevant question. If a shaila is so close as a layperson that light is going to make a difference for you, you should ask a shaila. Okay? Whether the posek decides to use it is a different question. And different poskim, by the way, have very different standards for themselves about when they'll go out to the sunlight. You know, some poskim, they'll look at it in the inside, and if they think it's particularly difficult, then they'll go say, if you ask a child at night, they'll say, come back tomorrow because I want to look at it in the sunlight. And some poskim, I remember I once I once had to, as a colorblind rabbi, I do a lot of schlepping around to bring maros to other poskim. So I remember once I was in Queens for Shabbos or something, and I had Rabbi Willig was around, so I usually go to, and I had to bring this child to somebody else, and I went over right after Shabbos. I brought this over to this Rav's shul right after my erev on Motzei Shabbos. And it was a very like a time sensitive issue for that, if you're going to the mikveh that night. And so I walked to the shul, I handed him this. I said, I had this introduced myself. I said, I have this shayla, and he put it in his pocket, and he said, okay, you know, I'll call you. What's going on here? So he was a posek who he has lechatchila. He doesn't even look at electric light at all. Lechatchila's first step is always wait for the sun, no matter what. When I told him that it was time sensitive, so he said, all right, I'll look at it now, and if he can make a judgment, so different posts have different standards about that. Any more questions? Okay, anyone have any other questions that you feel like you want to ask me? Feel free to email or call me. Rabbi Sinensky has my contact information. I'm always happy to help. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Once again, thank Rabbi Berger so much for sharing of his valuable time and wisdom.